and welcome to Ranting About Dragons and Shit. Podcasters, two authors, and a writer get together and talk about the ways they tell stories. I'm one of your hosts, Trevor Bettis, your resident... No, that's the old one. I'm the writer of Isle Champions of the Forgotten Realms and host of too many podcasts. And with me each week are two amazing people who are...
I'm Aaron M. Evans. I write fantasy novels, best known for the books The Usurper and the Brimstone Angels Saga.
It is I, B. Dave Walters. We just recorded our first episode of the Morning Glory Milking Farm book club, so I have a lot of fantasy phallic imagery running through my head right now.
Oh, good lord. Yeah, if you haven't listened to that one yet or read along with the book, highly recommend you do it. It's going to be a fun time.
Yep. We're only two chapters in. There's time for you yet.
Yes. And yes, that episode should be out right now as you're listening to this. It is I'm categorizing it as a bonus episode, so hopefully it's easy to find on there. If not, just keep scrolling. I wanted to say this because Aaron, you brought up the books of the Usurper. One of those is coming out pretty soon.
Hey.
Yes. In fact, it is coming out next Tuesday. So Relics of Ruin is finally here. So if you listen to this, you have a very narrow window, which you can pre-order it and then take your pre-order information. And there is a link on my Instagram, and there's a link on my Twitter, and there's a link on the Discord where you can fill out a Google form and get some cool pre-order swag. That's like a bookmark and some art cards and some stickers.
Yeah. I will also say, where it is, the author, who is both brilliant and beautiful, is having a Reddit AMA next week.
That's true. Come to our fantasy on Thursday, May 2nd, and ask me anything, especially because it's my birthday.
Yeah. As well.
So for my birthday, if you want to buy my book and then come ask me questions, you'll be my favorite Tangerino.
Oh. What time?
It starts all day. I think it starts at 9 a.m.
9 a.m. EST.
Yeah. So, AMA. Yeah, you make a post, and then you stick around and answer questions. I might plan right now is to bake myself a birthday cake while I answer questions, because that is something I can talk about, too.
I'm making, I love that.
I haven't picked what to make, though, so...
Just not carrot cake. Anytime someone has a carrot cake for their birthday, it just makes me sad.
My grandmother's carrot cake recipe is actually really good, but there's a lot of other options, so I'm not disagreeing.
I agree with you.
Yeah. Valid.
My favorite, I made this thing called a princess torta once, which is this like Swedish cake. So it's like a vanilla cake, a sponge, and then it's got like raspberry jam, and it's got crumb patisserie, so it's kind of like if you mix pudding and whipped cream together, and then I think it also might have whipped cream on it, and then you put like a layer of marzipan over the whole thing, like green marzipan in this big old dome, and then a little flour on top. That was one of the most elaborate things I've made.
I mean, obviously it's your birthday, so whatever makes you happy, but yes, I'm gonna co-sign that thing that you just described. Yes.
Make another opera cake. Just gonna make opera cakes for days.
For days. Well, how y'all feel about answering some more listener questions?
My body's ready.
Let's do it. This is the second question. I believe their name is Cameron that sent in, who said, do not read all of them at once because they can't handle all the spotlight. So here we go. This one is about staying motivated. Hello there, Tangent Earls. Tangent Earls. Tangent Earls. I'm going with that one. Something you guys have talked about a lot on the show, and especially recently with NaNoWriMo. This was, we took a while to get to this one, sorry. Is holding off on your passion project until you're ready for it, and specifically with graphic novels, the metaphor of working your way up the weight class for teaming with an artist, so not to start out with your magnum opus. I took this to heart and worked out the kinks in two back burner ideas so that they are strong and steady enough for outlining and writing, and now I have basically the next 12 years roughly planned out with
gracious.
That's a lot with four specific stories that increase in length and emotional importance to me. I might do NaNoWriMo, although for me, I guess it's Nangra Na Scrimo, National Graphic Novel Script Writing Month. For the first one, because I think I could honestly slam out the rough draft of the script in decent-ish time, but I've run into a problem. Hitting pause on my big, very cool fantasy story with characters I love so much to shift to much shorter sci-fi story that's pretty cool, but I just barely met you. Has basically tanked
your story on the side. Yeah, right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Has basically tanked my inertia and motivation. I know how this smaller first story goes, so it's not a depth of concentration problem. I have all the beats bulleted out, but getting into the detailed outline has been really slow going because I'm more easily distracted and bored. Trying to remedy this by switching back to the passion project doesn't work either, because knowing it won't ever start to become a real thing for like 10 years squash my inertia there too. BDiv has talked about doing Ronin work at times that pulls time away from passion things, and I'm sure Trevor and Aaron have a similar situation where deadlines demand one project over the other. So how do you get pumped up, energized, and motivated when you need to work on a project that you know you will fall in love with soon, you just haven't gotten over the most recent breakup yet? Sincerely, apparently the only listener that's a graphic novel stan, where are my peeps at?
Hold on. Here, with you. Yeah.
I got one more. It's a PS. Mm-hmm. PS. Mm-hmm. My sister had to read The Road for her college class. As you might have guessed, it was supposed to be a great example of modern literature, and her professor loves it, but my sister hated every minute of it. When she was venting to me, I told her how BDiv hates The Road at least once a month, and she said that she's never felt more vindicated in her life.
Awful. Look, let me tell you something. If you were to take The Road and submit it as your final project in a creative writing course anywhere in the country and scrub the name Cormac McCarthy off the front, let's put the plagiarism to the side, if you were just like I wrote this thing, you would get an F in 100% of those classes. Once you establish yourself to a certain degree, you can break the rules, and it is a great story. Yep. But I mean, the way it's told is god awful. Now let me say something real quick. Because I don't remember the exact instance you're referring to, and I don't think that's something that we said like that. I think what we said is your skills are going to increase over time, and mm-hmm. so you're not going to paint your Mona Lisa first just because yes. you can't. Not that you shouldn't necessarily try.
Yeah.
Because one thing we've said a lot of times is follow the passion.
Yep.
If you're, you know, I don't know. I'm gonna call it your Lord of the Rings for the sake of ease. If that's what's speaking to you, write it, man.
Yeah.
You know, because no matter what, you're going to get down the road and be like, oh, I could have done this better. But that's going to be true no matter what. So, yeah.
And the other thing I would push back on slightly is that this is the best idea you're ever going to have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because like you might write it and then realize you could do something else. You might, you know, this is my fond hope. I hope every book I write is more interesting than the last one.
Yeah.
I don't want to ever just churn out a book because I can write 100,000 words in order. Yep. Right. Yep. And so think of it that way. Like the first thing doesn't have to be the be all and all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Honestly, I'm not going to say this as a blanket true statement, but like my concern with doing this, if it were me, is that I'm putting that other story that I've already have this like kind of grandiose idea about, I'm putting it on an even higher pedestal. Mm-hmm. So that like, say I did go all the way through all of those books and then finally got to the point of writing that, I might actually find the same fear of writing it that I had at the beginning. Because I've built it into this big thing that I have to make great.
That you're putting a lot of unnecessary pressure on yourself. And quite frankly, that's why George R. R. Martin stuck. Well, there's a lot of reasons, up to and including he didn't plan it.
He got Cormac McCarthy and George R. R. Martin in the same question.
I did. You know what it is? We took a couple weeks off. That's why I gotta open the show with the greatest hits. You know, but you know, one of the few times that I will show some sympathy as a human. I'm sure he's put a lot of pressure on himself.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, I must make this magnificent. And I'm like, well, guess what? You're not gonna.
I have to make it magnificent. I have to thwart everybody's expectations. I have to be surprising when everybody's had 20 years to figure this all out.
Yeah. And quite frankly, already knows where you were going and hated it. So now you've got to also find a way to do not. It's like you're halfway through baking that cake you described. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I'm violently allergic to raspberry. And you're like, oh.
I'm going to pick every raspberry out of this somehow.
Right, yeah. No, it's cool. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it.
Even worse, B-Dave's looking over the recipe as you're cooking it. And it's like, oh, I've had this recipe before. I hate it.
And you're like, oh, but my grandmother taught me a way to do not this.
Yeah.
It's fine. I wouldn't even put those expectations on yourself. Now, what we might have said, because something I know is true, is oftentimes when you hear people that are one-hit wonders or whatever, and their first novel is the most success they ever had, or their first album is the most success they ever had, it's not that that was the peak of their talent. It was when they had the most time to polish and the minimum amount of stress. They had forever to make their baby exactly what they wanted. And as Aaron well knows, and I've gone through this too, you take the time to do the thing that's the thing you meant, and they're like, great, do a better thing in half the time.
Yeah.
You know, and you're like,
I think the thing that I might have said that was closest to this was that, like, the first book that I wanted to write, I eventually got to the point where I was just like, I need to stop trying to write this because I'm just getting stuck here, and I need to go to something else, and I'll come back to this later. But that was a very, like, me in the moment situation.
Yeah.
And that did end up being the right move for me then. But I'm not saying that's what everyone should do if you've been working on something for a long time. I will say, I do recommend if you've been working on the same thing for 10 years to just try writing something else. Not that that first thing's still going to be great. You may never go back to that thing, and that's okay.
Yeah, follow your excitement. Now, another thing that I've said, because again, I want to make sure that I say out loud, I don't think any of us would tell someone who was excited and passionate about a thing to not do that thing.
100%.
They are feeling excited and passionate about that thing.
Yeah.
Now, I have very much preached the gospel of multiple projects. Mm-hmm. But it's for that exact same reason, because sometimes the thing is not going to be doing it for you. If Lord of the Rings is stuck in the mud, well, okay, pull out your Star Wars fan fiction. You know what I mean? If that's where your energy is drawing you. Now, to answer the specific question, though, you said, what do you do when you're stuck? What do you do, especially when you got deadlines coming?
Yeah, the exact thing was where deadlines demand one project over the other. So how do you stay? How do you get pumped, energized, and motivated when you need to work on a project that you know you will fall in love with soon, but haven't gotten over the most recent breakup yet?
I'm gonna give you an answer that you're not gonna like. There's a Stephen King quote that I live by: that amateurs talk about inspiration, professionals go to work. The hardest part is starting. The hardest part is starting every time.
Yeah.
And I don't just mean the hardest part is starting the project. I mean that day, sitting down, the document is open, my fingers are on the keyboard. Yeah. Now is the time to do the thing. That is the hardest part every time. I would say Stephen Pressfield, The War of Art. If you get your hand on Stephen Pressfield, The War of Art, it is very short. Stephen Pressfield is a genius because he talks a lot about the creative process, and he comes back to all the time, the resistance is what he calls it. And the resistance is every reason not to do the thing. And what I would say is, unfortunately, there is a certain amount of just willpower, but I would couch that with, because I'm the person that always tells you that willpower fails over time. Like, you cannot just brute force everything all the time. Let yourself know that what you're trying to form is the discipline. The discipline of I do 2,000 words a day, or I do 3,000 words a day, or whatever. And that's just the discipline. But completely remove yourself from I do 2,000 great words a day.
Yeah.
Because you may not. Statistically speaking, you won't.
Yeah.
You know, and even if your goal is to do 2,000, there's days you'll do 500. There's days you'll do zero, and that's okay. That's okay. You know, like that's all part of the process. But in that attempt to do 2,000, there's also days that you'll do 5,000 because you go crazy monkey and you just run with it. I would say the last thing, and then I'm going to stop monologuing, is you always hear me come back to just write a word, word, not even a sentence. Just say, I'm going to write a word. Because if you write a word, you'll probably write a sentence. And if you write a sentence, you'll probably write a paragraph. Yeah. And if you write a paragraph, you might write a page, you might not. But even if you just got the word over a long enough timeline, the thing will get done. And as you build up the discipline and the habit, it becomes easier, understanding that, you know, some days are just going to be easier than others.
Yeah. The deadline thing, I mean, like, and, you know, writing, I will say this, writing something that you're not even in love with. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, I have written, I want to say at this point, over 25 adventures for Isle Champions. Yep. And like, I'm not in love with every one of them, but like, I have a week to write an adventure. So my butt's in the seat and I'm writing an adventure with dialogue and everything like that. And I'm not saying that just because I'm not in love with it, I'm not giving it my best work. Yep. But that is, I mean, I even said this today, in chat while I was, sitting in on Sketching Hour, which is a show that we do, for CNE, where the artists were saying that, like, oh yeah, you know, like we have an hour to draw these images here. We have more time to do it, you know, when we're working on other stuff and everything. And very much the same thing with writing, though, for me is like, as a hobbyist, I had as much time as I wanted to write and polish, like B-Dave was saying. And now I have to write an adventure in a week. Yep. And there has to become a point where it's like, this is good enough. And I'm, yep, I can be happy enough with putting that out for players to read.
Yep. Yeah.
And so it is, it, oh, wow. That's, it's more important for it to get done, yep, than for me to sit there and not do it.
Yep.
I think the other thing, sorry, go ahead.
I was this final, well, I'm about to sneeze anyway, so please. We all break down simultaneously. Take it.
I'm leaving the pause in there because I'm just like, this is a sneezing and a coughing break.
Sorry. I laughed at the wrong point and it made me cough. I'm getting over bronchitis. So this is another thing, is that don't think of it necessarily as a thing I must write and I don't want to, and a thing I will be beautifully inspired to write and it will flow from my fingertips like magic.
Yep.
You can write a thing because you are like, I have to get 1,000 words down today, and you just sit down and you're going to write 1,000 words and you're not going to stress about it. You're just going to get it done. And in the process of doing that, it will become easier and you will find what you love about this work.
Mm-hmm.
Even things where I have written them because I said, I will write this for you and I will take your money. Thank you. and I thought I was going to go in and I was just going to check out and just, you know, make the words handed in. At some point, I started caring a lot about that story because that's what I do. And so even for this, when you've got this plan that you're going to write this thing, you're going to kind of build your skills. The way you build your skills is not by being struck by inspiration. It's by sitting down, like B-Dave says, sit down, do the work, right? And also by sitting down and doing the work, you will generate that passion and that inspiration. You will find a way to love it more, because honestly, sitting and writing something that you don't like is hard.
Yeah.
Your brain will find how to love it. You will go, if I just do this, suddenly I am way more into it.
Yeah.
And you will make that little change. So like, just do it. You'll get there.
100%.
Yeah. One thing that, I won't say, that I don't like about myself, but it's not something that I'm the most proud of. I thrive with the external pressure.
Oh,
It's
yeah.
better for me when I'm like, I must have it done by this time, or here's this negative consequence. And I can't even like stick and carrot myself, like, because I'm like, ooh, I gotta have it done, or I can't go on the internet. I'm like, yeah, I can. You know,
right? I can't do that sort of thing because it's like I'm an adult. I'll just do what I want. It has to be something genuinely like a problem.
Yeah, like external to me. If I do not do this thing by this time, here's this thing I don't want to happen is going to happen. So, but I mean, dare I say, we're all like that. That's why deadlines exist.
Yeah.
I mean, if we all were capable of just working at maximum capacity, just be like, get it to me when you get it to me, because I know you're going to get it to me as fast as you can. So.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I hope that answered your question. Yeah. All right, let's go on the next one. Hello to the tangentially terrific trio. I wrote in recently about my frustration with the notion that success in the writing role is too often viewed through the lens of, have you written a book yet? Thank you guys for your encouraging and insightful responses. I would love to say that I immediately followed your advice and just stuck to what makes me happy, but I wouldn't be a writer if I didn't pointlessly bash my head against the wall one last time. I took one more crack at writing a long thought about book, almost immediately had an overdramatic breakdown, been there, and finally accepted that it wasn't for me. I have since been focusing much more happily on creative endeavors that don't lead me into an endless string of existential crises. I fully support
good.
Yes. Chief among these has been expanding the work I do as a dungeon master. In addition, to some of my home games, I also work as a professional DM running RPG sessions at the local library. Heck yeah!
What? Is that a thing?
Nice. That is a thing. Yeah.
That's sarcasm. I'm amazing.
Oh no! I thought you meant about the library thing, not the you are the professional DM. I was clapping for the local library thing because I had a friend that did that. I did them at Barnes and Nobles, and that is incredibly rewarding. Happy to hear you're doing that. While there are lots of things I'm good at in this role, one thing I struggle with is describing physical locations on the fly. As such, I tend to write a lot of box text, notes, etc. to help me out. Even then, however, I often feel like my descriptions are a bit lacking. I can write them, but it is a weakness. I'm wondering if any of you RPG inclined folks might have advice on help with that. Are there any tricks you follow to help you write descriptive text for RPGs or otherwise? How much is too much? Do I maybe just need to keep practicing until it's more natural stew? I used to think that this is also just like good stuff for like writing in general, because like this is kind of the like you're going to be writing this on the fly as well. Like when you are sitting down to write it, you're going to go back and edit it. But in that first initial pass, you are writing it on the fly. And I kind of think of that in the same way when I am describing as a DM, like I'm going through those same thought processes as if I were at the keyboard, writing out the description. And it's essentially just like, hey, I have this image in my head. And there are these things that I see as being important, things that are pulling me into that scene. Those are the things I'm going to describe. If it is raining in Waterdeep, I'm going to talk about the sound of the rain on the cobblestone and the way that the water is, you know, reflecting off of it or anything like that. Like I'm the things that are pulling me into that scene with like imagery and stuff. That is what I'm going to just bounce around and describe to pull everyone else into that scene as well. What about you all?
So I for describing a physical place, like, you know, there's two things come to mind. One is when you want to put a character in the scene, you know, like Trevor's kind of pointing at you describe how their senses take it in. What does it look like? What does it smell like? What does it taste like? What does it feel like? What does it sound like? Right. You don't have to hit all of those every time. Mm-hmm. When people get in that groove, it's really obvious. Yeah. But smell is the one people forget the most. And it's the one that's got the most possibility of being really visceral. And this is the thing. If you pick details that are really specific
and that provoke a specific emotional response, they're going to stick with your players better. Whether that's because it tells them this is a very comfortable place, it tells them this is a very dangerous place, it grosses them out really bad. These are good details. The other thing is sort of when it comes to sort of just describing spaces, this is one thing where it's like slightly different for RPG. Like players always want to know, how big is this room, right?
I didn't ask how big it is. I said I cast fire.
That's the thing I always have to remember, because I'm like, I don't think about, I'm not good at estimating distance. I have a little bit of dyscalculia in that. And I'm like, I don't know, 100 feet.
Yeah.
But that kind of thing, and giving, and one thing about that too, especially because like if you're looking at text in a novel, and if you tell me like a room is 100 feet long, this is kind of inert.
Yeah.
And also it's, you know, there are some characters where I like totally buy that they've, it's that my character, you know, you're like, oh, you know, Himbo McDecimator comes in and he's 6'4".
Okay,
like,
excuse me, I'm right here,
Aaron. Sorry, 6'9". And that doesn't tell you a whole lot, but saying I'm as big as the door, the way B-Dave does, gives you an immediate picture, right? So giving them things that are for, you know, that help them estimate the space. You know, there are, you know, 10 large archways that you could, you know, stand in and only touch the edges with the tips of your fingers. You think it's about 100 feet or whatever it is. I don't do distance. I just don't like it. But getting a sense of like, you know, terms for things helps, like architectural stuff. Knowing like what's, I have to look this shit up constantly.
I can't tell you what a plinth or a dais are.
But people like when you say those words.
They love dais. They love dais.
They love it, right? Dais is a stage.
Yeah.
I'm like, is it a podium? Cursed things are on daises. That's what I know. If you describe the thing as being on a dais, do not touch it.
Innocent things are on altars. Cursed things are on daises.
Correct. If it's on a dais or a plinth, do not touch it. That's what
I had to go
look
up. What's the wall around a balcony recently? Balustrade.
Yeah, you've given me no information. It's funny that you mentioned the dyscalculia thing, because I'm terrible at spatial relations also.
Yeah.
Like I just looking at a space and knowing what will fit in there, I can't.
I'm good at, but I can't tell you how big things are.
Well,
numbers don't stick together with the thing I'm looking at.
When I'm DMing, like this part is very much like the DMing side of it. Like what I will do is like I will give that initial description like I would in a book, where I'm just like, there, you know, it's a large room, elegantly decorated, tapestries hanging from the walls and everything. And then after I do that, after essentially I say improvised block text, I go, okay, so this room's 40 by 40. Like I will then break it down mechanically for the players, unless I have roll 20 up or something like that.
I almost certainly will not mention size unless someone asks. If I know there's like a big thing in there, or if it's high enough to fly, I'll say things like high ceilings, or they go up into the darkness, you're not sure how high it is. My secret technique, which I encourage you to steal, dear listener, whoever you are, is you tell me what it's like. All you got to do is set it up a little bit. Like you walk in and there's a bustling bazaar. You tell me what it's like. You walk into the room and there's blood everywhere. It's terrible. You tell me what it's like. Like you give them something. You know what I mean? You can't just be like, you walk into a room. What's in the room? You're like, treasure. We're like, we win, right? You know what I mean? Yeah. Like 10 million golds in the room. Yeah. So it's like you walk into the kitchen and it's a ghost town. You know, honestly, you can just say you walk into the kitchen and it's a ghost town, and you told them already. Because I'll tell you, a trick to modules, again, dear listener, is if something is described in the module, you can interact with that thing. If they take the time to tell you there's four cups on the table, check the cups, or the fact that four people were eating here is important or something. Like, I mean, almost everything is Chekhov's gun. If it takes the time to be like, there's a cabinet and it's filled with china, you know what I mean? Like, mess with the cabinet, mess with the china, right? So you don't have to go, unless it's on a plant, then don't
fucking touch it.
Do not mess with the china, right? Yeah. Less is more oftentimes, because the thing is, especially when you're telling horror, but, you know, I've given this example many times, let them fill it in, because they will fill it in their mind with the most of that thing.
Yeah.
Again, if I say the most beautiful woman you've ever seen, that means something to them.
Yep.
You know, if I say a gorgeous elf, that means something to them. The moment I now start describing characteristics, well, that's my conception of what's, but I've now taken them out of that, you know? Yep. You can just say she's gorgeous, but she looks at you with madness in her eyes and venom in her smile. I don't have to tell you, well, she's 5'7" and she's got green eyes. She looks powerfully upset. You know,
she entered the scene tits first.
Don't do that.
Yeah. As
I was going along with the voice he was right. doing.
Oh, no, no, no. I get it.
As D&D elves are wont to do, right? So I don't know that you have to give some huge block text of description, because a lot of times people are going to lose that stuff anyway.
Yeah.
If you just say, the hustle and bustle of Waterdeep is on grand display as merchants and shopkeepers and callers are peddling their wares, and the city is alive around you. That's it.
Perfect.
You
know? That's it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And then they're like, whoa, is there a place I can get some mutton? Yeah, there's a place you can get some mutton, you know?
Yeah, because no matter what player, you could give them like a 2-page description and they're still going to be like, but is there a magic shop here?
Right. Yeah. Their brains aren't going to retain it anyway. So don't shut the thing you got to remember, and sorry to detour into this so much, listeners who only care about writing, but being a storyteller as a dungeon master is still directly applicable. Your job is to elicit an emotional reaction.
Yeah.
Your job isn't to tell them that they're in a 20x20 square space. I mean, that matters for casting Fireball, which again, I didn't ask. I said I cast.
Always ask me. They always ask me every time. Either I make a map or I have to tell them the exact dimensions of a fucking room, and I hate making maps.
I'm done. To elicit an emotional response. There is a tactical component to the game of like, is it a straight line? Can I hit him with my lightning bolt? I mean, but again, when they're like, is it a straight line? Can I hit him with my lightning bolt? I'm just like, yes or no, you know? Or I'm like, you could move and you could do it. You know what I mean? Because a lot of times those things are loading in my mind too. That's not the point. If it's creepy and claustrophobic, that's what you want to get across. Mm-hmm. And dare I say, when you're getting into the minutiae, it's hard for me to describe a room that is going to make your skin crawl as the slime is dripping down the walls onto your helmet, and then be like, it's also 65 feet long. You know what I mean? Like, I'm accessing different parts of your brain.
I'm taking this as permission not to explain it in the future. Yeah. And I'm very excited about that.
Cite me as a reference. Yes.
You know? Dave says I don't have to tell you.
It's true.
Did your character take some sort of surveyor's background? Right? No? No? Then you think it's pretty big.
You know, again, this is one of those different tables for different people. Some people really get into the 5x square grid combat thing, you know, and that's the way they like to play the game. And, you know, God bless those people. I'm just not those people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
Nope. That's good. Well, Stu, I hope that helps you out. And good luck continuing running those library games.
Hooray.
The next one we got says, hello, my story is a series that involves two timelines similar to something like the Kingkiller Chronicles. There are a few present day chapters where the main character is being hounded by the man, parentheses, fuck the man, hell yeah, to explain what the hell happened. The bulk of the book is in the past, my main character's actual story. My question for you is, at the end of the series, how much of the final book should the wrap up of the present day plot be? I feel as having it as its own act would be a little much, and was leaning more towards like 3 to 5 chapters of straight present timeline to close out the series. Also, is changing the tense from present to past tense to coincide with the two different timeline chapters a good idea? I think the first blanket statement we're going to say on here is do what you want to do. Like, if you want, if that's how you want to tell your story, do it. Personally, yeah, I think the tense switching, yes, I think that's totally fine. I think that's cool. Aaron even has that in the Usurper stories.
Available next week. Book one is available now. Book two is available next week. Refined novels are sold.
As far as like how much needs to be there, like I think that is really dependent on what story you want to tell there. The funny thing is that they cite Kingkiller Chronicles, but my brain actually went to Persona 5. I don't know if folks out there have played that one, but there are very small chunks of time that happen in the quote unquote present. And there's a lot that happens in the past, but then it does continue going on once we catch up from there. Whatever you feel that chunk of the story needs, an act, a few chapters, a paragraph, whatever services the story that you're trying to tell, I think is okay.
I think it's going to depend a lot on the project. Doing that sort of, because you cited Kingkiller Chronicles, which, you know, is an unfinished series, but the parts that have been done so far, my impression is that there isn't a whole lot that happens in the present. There's something coming, right? So it might be that that's what that needs, but a lot of the time when you have that kind of framing story, you don't usually need a whole lot of wrap up. But you might. I think it's okay to shift out, just to wrap up the past and then shift back to the present. It is okay to sort of balance those differently. A lot of books do a dual timeline, and you'll see plenty of cases where they drop the past once the past is sort of sorted out. Because the trick with this is often, you know, if the present timeline is based on you not knowing something about the past, like if the tension in the present timeline exists because you don't know how something worked out, and then we find out how it worked out, then the tension's gone and you might as well wrap that up unless you get something else in your pocket. The only thing about the switching tenses that I would caution is, you know, it's going to depend a lot on the story. In the example that Trevor gave for the Books of the Usurper, so there is a past timeline, and that's like 5 or 6 chapters throughout the book, and they're short chapters. So it's a little taste. It's like a little palate cleanser between courses. So yes, you have a big, like, now get this. And there are lots of books that do switch tenses, you know, between chapters. Obelisk, what's the first one? Is it Obelisk Gate? It's not Obelisk Gate. N.K. Jemisin's series.
She's a homie. You know what? I should invite her to come on here. She's a friend of mine. How did I never think of that until...
Die. She's this amazing. Exact I will be sec. Just like, oh.
We've done like 120 episodes of this show, and like never at any point did it ever register in my consciousness that I could just ask Nora to come on the show.
Say hey.
Hey.
Multiple Hugo winner, you know, Grandmaster, world-renowned Nora K. Jemisin, would you like to come be on our podcast?
Guess who taught her how to write screenplays? This guy. Yeah.
So are you talking about the 100,000 Kingdoms?
No.
The fifth season.
Fifth season. That's the first book, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Thank you. So Obelisk Gate is the second one, I'm pretty sure. Or maybe it's the third. I don't remember. I'm bad at titles this late it's when the I'm second sick. One. Anyway... That one does interesting things where it's got, you know, first person, it's got second person, it's got third person, it's got present tense, it's got past tense. And, you know, this works for some people. It does. I loved it. And so this is kind of the thing. What are you getting out of shifting that tense is the big question. Because if it is just signaling I have gone from past to present, then I would say you're probably better off staying with past. For Books of the Usurper, the reason I chose to do the switch is that there is very much meant to be sort of a tonal difference between the two. In Empire of Exiles, those interstitials are, the man known as the Usurper, Rodolfo Carracci, and his brother in his tiny office room where he's been under house arrest, talking about what he did. And what he did affects what happens in the present, but it never leaves this tiny room. And my feeling is that present tense is the scope is narrowed because the next thing hasn't happened yet. The space is tighter, right? It feels more claustrophobic. It feels more like zoomed in. In Relics of Ruin, minor spoiler, plug your ears if you didn't read Empire of Exiles. Rodolfo Carracci is beyond the wall, out in the wide world. He only knows as much as is around him. And beyond that, it is unknown, right? So this present tense stays and it works because, again, we're trying to emphasize the smallness of it. So I would personally not recommend doing it like past because I'm in the past, present because I'm in the present, because it's not, it's going to have it's going to trip your reader a little bit, and it is only giving you one thing that they're fine with. People are fine with understanding this part is past tense, this part is present tense. Now, if it gives you something else, if you want your present sections to feel more like we don't know the next thing, if you really want to like hammer that down, it might be the right tense for you. But really think about all the things that the tenses bring to the party. And do remember, when you make a reader switch, that's a little bit of work you're handing them, and you're gonna lose readers right away. As soon as you give readers work to do, you'll lose some of them, and that is okay. Some people, every book is not for everybody, and some people really hate switching tenses. So, like, make these choices intentionally is my big suggestion.
The one thing I want to plug onto that one is the for like another thing, another reason you could have for switching the tenses, because I've heard a lot of people say that they find present tense to be more urgent. And so like if there's an urgency that you want to get in there with the present, that could be another reason to do it.
I know you will be shocked,
I'm
longtime
shocked.
listeners, to hear me say that I think the structure is what's the most important. It's what does the narrative need to be doing in that moment, and is that better served in the present or the past? Right. I don't know that there is a. I don't know that there is a formula of you need to spend 20% in the past and 40% in the present. You know what I mean? And that's not a thing. To be able to tell the story effectively with a beginning, middle, and end in the proper rising action, denouement, conclusion, where do those events need to take place and do that?
And I would say, especially since like you're saying that this is a series, don't I would recommend not trying to plan out that far ahead of like how many chapters at in the last book of this you're going to use for that. Do what the
Oh,
story
I
needs.
missed that we're talking about. Oh, baby doll. No, don't worry about that. Like that, I honestly, when you're planning a series, if you're trying to like block it out, you're as you go, you the book you're working on, yeah, detailed outline, highly recommend. Books ahead of that, you want like a synopsis, like a summary, like here's what's gonna happen. Because something's going to change. Every book you add to the series, something is going to change. Have I told you originally when I started Brimstone Angels, I thought Farida was going to die at the end. I thought that was what was going to happen. And I there were all actually, and every time that I added a book and I thought, okay, this is the last book because, I got contracts in chunks. It had a totally different ending. There were ones where like Lorkin was the big villain that had to be defeated. There were ones where Havilar had to sacrifice herself because as you're writing them, the story is going to shift with what it needs to be. Don't try to write a chapter by chapter outline that's, down the road in a series that you're just starting out on. It is just busy work, frankly. It is just taking time away from the book that you want to be writing.
Fair. I did miss this, and I meant to say it. The sign off I love is many thanks, some guy.
Hey, some guy.
Hey, some guy. Hope that helped you out. So all right, next one. Hello, I have listened to every episode of yours. Well, thank you. You're too kind. You three wonderful people have helped my book progress from a dinky little 156-page garbage post to a magnificent novel that represents my soul, my years of hard work, and everything I thought about with the characteristic blank stare in my eyes while sitting in a class about something I don't remember, parentheses, because I was thinking about this book. Seriously, my book is so much bigger and grander than I ever could have dreamt, and it's all because of you tangent lords. I am ready for this sucker to go into publishing, almost. My book is done, but there is one thing I'm missing that I can't figure out how to fix. In my book, the main character is introduced as a young man who is destined to become a hero who sacrifices his life to save the world, and he isn't the first one. This cycle has repeated endlessly since times long forgotten. My character, however, is completely and totally against this horrible destiny. He knows that every hour he spends denouncing his destiny, every day he spends running from it and trying to change it, his death still stays ever present. The only thing he changes is the road to get there, and the road is filled with the bodies of those he could have saved by getting his destiny over with. However, he doesn't care. He tries his hardest to run, to change his fate, to break the ever-spinning cycle. Throughout the book, his friends and mentors try to be there for him, but he stays distant, knowing he doesn't need another reason to run. In the book, it seems like he's finally accepted his destiny, though begrudgingly, and faces it head on. Though, as a series of unforeseen events, he is finally placed with a choice. He can fulfill his destiny in the way that he's supposed to, saving the universe and dying. Lots of boring stuff. He put that, not me. The other option he takes, taking up the mantle, the power of the very antagonist he was supposed to die fighting. This ends the book and sets the course for all the other characters from other books I have planned to come together to stop the new evil in an epic Marvel Avenger type team up. My issue is, throughout the book, I have the readers cheering for the main character to do what is right, to accept his fate, even though they know he will die. So I don't know how to keep the emotion strong, keep the readers loving the main character in the final few chapters, where he moves to become a new evil. The entire purpose of this book is a prologue to all the other books. In the words of B-Dave, the villain is the hero or victim of their own story. This character thinks he is breaking the cycle, doing something that needs to be done, but the readers know better. So that's where I'm stuck. I don't know how to keep this character being loved by the readers. Any advice would be wonderful, and tips or anything I would greatly appreciate. Sorry this is so long, Zayden. So I seeing this one, I know this very much ties into B-Dave's love for Arthas and Anakin and everything like that.
I wrote multiple notes, but the top note I wrote is Arthas.
Yeah. I did read this one beforehand, and like very much what you have talked about ran through my head for that. Like what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I feel like Aaron had something queued up, because I will not forget my woe and lamentation, but I feel like there's something she wants to say.
I feel like my first question is, what are you trying to say with this? Like, what is this doing thematically? Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't sound clear to me. I don't know, you know, if I'm supposed to root for him in all his decisions, but his decisions are wildly different, why is it something I'm still rooting for? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you can have something where there's like some revelation that makes me go, oh, this is the way to go. And you can have something where it is this downward collapse, you know, the villain falling into tragedy. Those don't sound like what Trevor just described. Mm-hmm. And so that's the first big thing. Take a step back thematically. What are you doing here? What are you trying to say? That I think will tell you what needs to change in this. The other thing, you talk about it being a prequel to the next kind of set of stories. a lot of the times when you get prequels like this, where you see the fall of the villain, they come out after the book. You're not, this is backstory to the thing you actually want to tell potentially. People are into it, right? Like, you know, the fact that we got episodes 1, 2, and 3 of Star Wars before, after we got 4, 5, and 6 is because, you know, it is way more engaging to go into that story knowing that Anakin is destined for something more villainous. For Hunger Games, you have the Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. And frankly, I think if you read that book without knowing, you know, how that character fits into the original trilogy, it wouldn't be as satisfying because it is just watching somebody choose make the wrong choice. And not in the way where you're necessarily like, you know, well, I really only have my son's take to go by, but he was very like, why is he doing any of this? Yeah.
It's okay.
That's what I got. I'll stop there.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have a thing, but I feel like you're going to say this,
No,
Speedy.
no, no.
So I'm gonna take.
I got no. Say
Well, no,
anything.
it
Say
has
anything.
to do with Anakin and Arthas. So I want if you don't say it, I'll pick it up from there.
Sure. A few things. Yes. Characters like Arthas Menethil from Warcraft, Anakin Skywalker, they're tragic. You know, that we see the path they're going down. And in Arthas, yes, usually it is a prequel, but in Warcraft 3, we didn't know that was gonna happen to Arthas. You find out fairly early in the narrative because somebody straight up tells him. But then you kind of take this ride with him. You got a couple of challenges, but again, those characters are tragic. Those stories are tragedies, and that kind of narrative gets framed much differently than a superhero narrative where at the last second you're like, you know what? Never mind. I'm the bad guy now. Psych. You know, that will leave people feeling very, very dissatisfied with it. You can have a hero that fails in the last moment. Remember, Frodo fails in the last moment, which is why Gollum is the real hero of the Lord of the Rings. But
Thought that sentence was going.
but so you can have somebody who's trying their best the entire time and comes up short or makes the wrong choice at the last second. If you have somebody that is sort of disagreeable and resistant the entire time, that is not a character that the audience is going to like. Because the hero must act and not be acted on. If the whole thing is this is your great glorious destiny, and you keep fighting it, and people keep dying around you, and you keep resenting your destiny, people won't like that person. So if your intent is to really make this person an unredeemable bastard by the end, you could do that. But I think the other important thing that makes an Arthas work, that makes an Anakin work, is they both meant well.
Yep,
They meant well
that's the one.
all along, right? And you, the reader, could be like, oh, this isn't my sweet summer child. This isn't the way. And in both narratives, somebody says to them, to their face, this is not the
But
move.
they knew better.
Right. And they're like, you know, I'm gonna save you and everybody else. And then watching that slide, you know, is a ride you can take with them, especially because the villain is the hero of their story. But even in that context, the hero still must act and not be acted on. 200 or 300 pages of you've got to jump in the volcano. I don't wanna. You've got to jump in the volcano. I don't wanna. Look at the village that burned down because the volcano is erupting. And you're like, I still don't wanna. Actually, I am the volcano. Duh. Yeah. Nobody's gonna like that.
Yeah, because one of the things that played through my head while I was reading this is that like now there's a whole other, you know, conversation to be have about like, you know, being destined to sacrifice yourself to save the world and everything like that. But like at the end of the day, this person trying to do everything they can to avoid, essentially avoid saving the world, n and as they said, n knowing that people are dying because they're not doing that falls into selfishness,
Which is
which,
evil.
yeah, and so I think the problem you might be running into with this is that the character is already being selfish and then chooses the selfish choice. Like there's no change there. That's just a straight arrow of like this person was selfish to begin with and they ended selfish. It like
Also,
the more interesting one there would be is like the whole time he's like, I've got to do this. People are going to die if I don't do this. And then he gets there and the villain's just like, hey, we could save the world even better.
Yep.
Yep. And
they can be scared. They can be afraid. They can hesitate. You know, they can try and leave and then get back in line, but they can't spend the whole time there. I'll say two things. I would say spoiler alert, but it's been 22 years or 12 years and the movie was stupid anyway. Cabin in the Woods, the ending of Cabin in the Woods. We could save the world. We're just kind of not gonna. Womp womp is fucking dumb. And the second thing, in the Millarverse, I don't know if you read comic books, Mark Millar is doing something similar with this, where the I say hero in air quotes because he's very much a villain of Wanted. They made the movie of Wanted with James McAvoy.
Yeah.
Angelina Jolie. The comic book's a little bit different, but the character's an assassin. His whole thing is he can kill anybody. That's his power.
Yeah,
I can kill you. He's the new big bad now. Like, I mean, he was kind of a bad person the entire time, but like all the other heroes are having to try and band together to stop him. So you know, there is a precedent for what you're trying to do, but I give all of that as footnotes as to everything else that has been said.
Yeah.
Also, fuck Cabin in the Woods.
The thing though that I do really want to like highlight from what B Dave was pointing out though, especially with like Arthas and Anakin, is again like they thought that they were doing the right thing. Like Arthas became the Lich King to stop the destruction of the kingdom, and Anakin was trying to save Padme and following all of these dark things in order to do it, and then just off to himself.
One thing people overlook, I know we're close on time and I don't want to dive too deeply into the tragedy of Anakin Skywalker, but he tries to do it by the book. He talks to them about his mother. He tells them what he sees. And the Jedi don't listen to him and his mom dies. Mm-hmm. And then it's happening again.
Yep.
You know what I mean? And he's like, well, this time I've got to handle it.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah.
He does try, my sweet boy. Today is my cat Anakin's birthday. And so I have to extra advocate Anakin. Anakin and Mal. They're six today. Right. Yep.
But yeah, I think taking a look at that character's story. I'm not saying anything else about your book as a whole. Do not take that as like we're attacking that. We're just saying take another look at this plot line for this character and see what you can do with it. But as you were saying, yeah, we are getting low on time, and I think that is a good place to wrap things up. Friends, where can people find you and what awesome things are you working on?
You can find me on Twitter and Blue Sky at Aaron M. Evans. You can also find me on the Dungeon Scrollers / Writing by Dragons Shit Discord. And most importantly, you can pick up my book, Relics of Ruin, as of Tuesday next week, April 30th. And again, when you hear this, you have a sliver of time to pre-order it. And get in, of course, those cool art cards and bookmarks and things like that, because I love to pay my fancy art friends for their work. So you get the benefit. And yes, please come by Reddit, come by our fantasy on Thursday, May 2nd to ask me anything and say happy birthday.
Yeah.
B. Dave Walters, I'm not going to take anything away from the fact that Aaron's book comes out next week. Buy the book, come to the AMA. That's it.
100%. Same thing. Trevor Best, go buy the book. That is going to do it for this week's episode. Thank you all so much for listening. Be sure to join our book club for Morning Glory and follow along as we read this very interesting book. If you enjoyed this episode, the best way to support the show is by leaving a review on your podcast service of choice and telling your friends about the show. If you'd like to write in with questions like the lovely people who did tonight, you can send those into writingaboutdragonsandshit@gmail.com. And if you'd like to keep up to the show, you can join our Discord, which has a link in the description below. Until next week, go write about some dragons and shit.
See only darkness. Thank you.